The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the University of Alberta, the Students' Union, or CJSR.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to a very special episode of Skeptically Speaking. Today, we are in the midst of our lovely host station's annual fundraising campaign. Yes, we are deep in the belly of CJSR's fund drive. So during today's show, we'll be alternating between discussing the wonders of science with comedian Brian Mallow and asking you to donate money. So before we introduce Brian, let's talk about CJSR. So CJSR is a community radio station. A community radio station that offers a skeptical call-in talk show a chance to be on the air. Is there another skeptical call-in show on the air? Not that I'm aware of. And is there another place that you could go that would offer you the chance to talk to experts about everything from storm chasing to geology, from Ogopogo to cults, from gender in the skeptical community to helping children become critical thinkers? I don't think so. And what other radio station is able to give you the opportunity to talk personally to people like Phil Plait, the bad astronomer, to Maggie Turnbull, who created the Habitable Planet Catalog, to Richard Saunders of the Skeptic Zone, and to actually interact with Daniel Loxton of Junior Skeptic Magazine? And what other show offered you the ability to be just a phone line away from Adam Savage? Just a phone line between you and skeptical awesomeness? This one right here, Skeptically Speaking, brought to you by CJSR. So show us your love, dial and donate now. The number is 780-492-2577, extension 1. And for all of you that send in email questions every week, we have an anti-social donation option for you as well. You can head over to our website at skepticallyspeaking.com, and right below Brian Mallow's picture, there's a little link that takes you directly to the online pledge form. And if you're listening to this via podcast, and I know many of you are, and you're thinking, oh boo, I didn't donate live, and now I can't donate at all, you are totally not out of luck, because the internets run 24 hours a day, my friends. You can donate online right now. And if you're listening to Skeptically Speaking on another radio station, maybe Citywide LP FM in Madison, Wisconsin, Public Reality Radio in Grand Rapids, Michigan, Rossland Radio in Rossland, British Columbia, or on Freethought Radio Online, maybe it would be nice to send them some money too, because they're all lovely stations who obviously value skeptical programming. But donate to CJSR first, please. So now before we get to science comedian Brian Mallow, we have someone else with us for Speaking Up. And speaking of speaking up, where else is it possible for you at home to have your voice heard on the air on a skeptical issue? Where, my friends, is it possible for would-be skeptical spokespeople to get some experience talking to a friendly interviewer and a welcoming audience? Oh yeah, right here. So on today's Speaking Up, we have Scott Gavura, someone who's actually been interviewed on Skeptically Speaking before. He was the lovely gentleman who was featured in the Ask a Pharmacist episode. Thanks for being with us on the show, Scott.
Hi, Desiree. How are you tonight?
I'm very well. How are you?
Very good, thanks.
So you're not here to speak about the Ask a Pharmacist episode. You're here to speak about something else.
Yeah, I thought it would be a good opportunity to speak about the H1N1 influenza pandemic. And what I want to specifically talk about, and maybe engage you as well, is about the media response to the pandemic. I mean, I think in particular, my concern is how I believe public safety is actually being threatened by bad information that's being propagated about vaccines. It's information that it's making it difficult for people to make informed decisions about their health. So, you know, as you're probably well aware, the flu season has started, and this year, we're dealing with both the annual seasonal flu, which you've probably had a flu shot for in the past, and then the H1N1 or swine flu. And there's going to be a vaccine for both. Now, we don't know how serious either flu will be this year. And just to put it in perspective, the regular flu is estimated to contribute to about 20,000 hospitalizations and about 4,000 deaths per year in Canada. So the flu is not an innocuous thing. I mean, most of us have had the flu in the past, and we've probably been very sick and stayed in bed for several days. You know, not that many of us require medical attention. Even fewer of us require hospitalization. But with each flu that comes around each year, we never know how it's going to evolve or if it will evolve and what it will actually look like when it hits. Now, the flu seems to be hitting British Columbia particularly hard. On Wednesday, CTV News reported that at one elementary school, one-third of the students were home from class. Now, we don't know yet if this is the H1N1 bug or not, right, but it's concerning. So the vaccine's a fairly important public health measure. It's one of the best measures that we've got, and it's going to be offered to people across Canada in order of priority based at, you know, who's at most risk of complications. And, you know, from the perspective of what we know, the swine flu doesn't seem all that bad right now, but we don't know how it's going to evolve. And now that I think we know more about swine flu than we did in the spring, it seems to be the reaction is really about vaccinations, and that's really brought the pseudoscience forward. And that leads me to what appears to be a true anti-vaccination backlash that's appearing across Canada.
Right.
So we've learned over the past that people don't like vaccines, you know, and I think we're seeing now that they really don't like vaccines to the point where they're willing to ignore facts. And some of it seems to be just more of a general reaction to science in general. But there's been a few notable events and activities across Canada. Just last weekend, there was a conference held in Montreal that claimed it was going to expose the military's plan to force vaccinations on everyone. So I haven't watched the proceeds from that. That's up on YouTube, but that's posted as well. So I'll have to take a look at what that had to say.
Can you tell us a bit more about what's going on in Vancouver specifically?
Yeah. In Vancouver, it's fairly interesting. The Georgia Straits, a newspaper with about 700,000 readers, and it recently ran an article by a Sonia McLeod, who's a homeopath, and she described in her column how she won't be immunizing herself or her children because she believes in the power of homeopathy. So I spoke about this when I was on before, and any of your listeners are not aware, homeopathy is an elaborate placebo system where there's no active ingredient. So homeopaths believe there's this magical life force, not a specific cause of disease. You treat symptoms, not the actual illness. So let's say you're a homeopath and you want to treat influenza. The most popular flu treatment is called, and I'll probably pronounce this wrong, I think it's Acyloconium. So, and I'll tell you how this is made because it's you'll be incredulous. You know, you take a duck's liver and a heart and you allow it to ferment in a jar for 40 days. This fermented goo that gets diluted. One drop in 100, and you shake it up, and you do it again and again and again, 200 times. It's an absurd amount of dilution. Once you've hit the 12th dilution, there's essentially no molecules of the original rotting duck liver and heart. It's just water.
Right.
But you dilute it again and again. You put those drops on lactose tablets, and there's your homeopathic flu treatment. So really, homeopathy is really a laughable practice. It's a scientific dead end. It doesn't really get any attention from science-based health professionals. But the column in Georgia Strait was different. It actually claimed that because of homeopathy, immunization wasn't needed. You know, and it's dangerous advice, and they need to be called on it. The feedback to the column was filled with some very critical comments, and the Strait obviously noticed as they wrote a follow-up article. But they didn't address the issue of that, you know, that we'd raise, that homeopathy is a placebo therapy with no efficacy. They just described the hospital medical errors, and they argued that therefore homeopathy is safer. You know, it's a complete straw man argument, irrelevant to the issue.
Mm-hmm.
The issue is whether or not homeopathy is an effective treatment to prevent or treat the flu, and the science is unequivocal. It doesn't. It's a placebo. So why is the Georgia Strait giving unqualified individuals a forum in a newspaper to spout demonstrably false information about homeopathy's efficacy? So we did a bit of digging, and there's more to the story than just bad science here. All over the Strait.com's website, there's ads for a company called Little Mountain Homeopathy. And who owns Little Mountain Homeopathy? Well, it's the business of Sonia McLeod, who was the author of the article. So she's on her website, she's selling homeopathic first aid kits and homeopathic immunizations. And homeopathy immunizations aren't immunizations at all. They're homeopathy. There's no active ingredient. So if you choose homeopathy immunization, you're really choosing no vaccination at all. So I and several other people asked the Strait to provide their conflict of interest policy, as it appears that Sonia McLeod's an advertiser on the site or has some other business relationship, and the article doesn't mention that. So we haven't seen a response to that. It's concerning. I mean, this is an article listed as a health feature, but it appears to be nothing more than an advertorial.
So, okay, before we get to the Georgia Strait article, you started off with secret military plan for forced H1N1 vaccinations? Who,
yeah,
what now?
Yeah, that's so often left field. I didn't spend a lot of time.
No, and I don't want to spend a lot of time, but really, there was an entire conference about it?
Yeah, well, that wasn't just the only topic. It was more about health freedom. And health freedom is a code for basically a lowered standard for safety and efficacy for natural health products. When you hear health freedom, that's what it means.
So there's no truth to, obviously, the conference. Or,
well,
sorry, the actual
see,
the military
look,
plan, I should say.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like there's a lot of credible science that was discussed there.
Color me surprised. Yeah. So
there's another interesting one, if I can quickly talk about that as well. It was in a CanWest paper about vaccines and autism. And the fact is that there's no debate among medical professionals. Numerous studies have demonstrated there's zero relationship between the two. But this article on CanWest, basically what they thought was a balanced story. They trotted out various people and groups who insisted, despite the science, that a relationship may exist. And, you know, the underlying premise that initiated this concern was demonstrated to be false. The data was faked in the original premise for the linkage. And despite the removal of thimerosal from vaccines, the rates of autism diagnosed haven't changed, but this manufactured controversy just continues to be propagated. And, you know, with the H1N1 vaccine will contain thimerosal, it gives people another reason to refuse the vaccine and a skewed sense of what the evidence really says.
So I have two issues with this. So what exactly constitutes a health article in the Georgia Strait? Like, could I write an article saying, like, rubbing green jello on your elbows is effective as vaccination, and it could get published? Like, are there any rules about evidence? Did you guys search for that?
We couldn't find any evidence about what the standards are in terms of what the content is. I mean, I think any sensible editor would have caught this and rejected this in terms of what it was advocating. I think it's one thing when you advocate homeopathy as a complement to evidence-based practice, but when you're describing it as a substitute, it's concerning because it's giving people misguided information around the evidence that supports, you know, valid public health measures.
And what about the conflict of interest issue?
Well, the conflict of interest is a concerning one. I think that it's important whenever someone provides information in a forum like in the media, it's important to disclose any conflicts of interest. And if there is a conflict of interest, it should be addressed. And I think it's quite concerning if there's an advertisement for the author's company and her blog at the same place as where the column's appearing. Mm-hmm. So I don't know the nature of the conflict, but it certainly is concerning, and we haven't seen a response yet about it.
So the Canadian skeptical bloggers have been all over this. So what kind of responses are you guys seeing on your blogs in the comment section?
There's certainly been a lot of traffic. I know of at least two articles that have appeared from Canadian skeptical bloggers, and I think it's been good to raise awareness. And I think what we're trying to do is raising, you know, as much awareness as we can around the issue around misinformation in the media.
Because there's been no formal response from the Georgia Strait at all.
No.
Okay.
Other than the second editorial, which talked about medical errors, completely off topic.
Right. So what's the plan now? Continued pressure?
I think so. I think that we want to do what we can to raise awareness about both editorial standards as well as the need for evidence-based information to be presented in a way that's meaningful. We can't, you know, I think that people need to make informed decisions around what they want to do in terms of vaccinations. If people aren't receiving evidence-based information, how is it possible to make an informed decision?
Right.
I think homeopathy is very concerning. I mean, you know, Desiree, I'm a pharmacist. If you come into my pharmacy for a drug and I tell you, you know what, I've got something better and it's more effective, and then I sell you a drug with no active ingredient, you know what happens to me? I lose my pharmacy license and I'll face criminal charges. But if I'm a homeopath and I do exactly the same thing, it's just business as usual.
Well, on that depressing note, do you maybe have anything else to tell the audience, Scott? Maybe perhaps about why they should donate to this program? Perhaps.
Well, I think that, Desiree, I think your program is fantastic in reaching both a broad audience and a really engaged audience. And it's a unique program. As you say, it's most likely or probably the only skeptical radio show. I think it is the only one. And I think, you know, you deserve kudos for the superb guests that you have on week after week, myself excluded.
I would say you're included. You were fantastic. We had so many emails about your show. And I don't know if you checked the comments section. Someone crushed on you.
Oh, nice.
Just so you know. Well, thanks very much for being here, Scott.
Okay, I enjoyed it.
Have a good day.
Thank you.
Bye. So again, folks, that is 780-492-2577, extension 1 to donate, or online via our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. There is a link there that leads you directly to the online pledge forms. So, and you know, we're going to introduce Brian, but I just want to take a moment to preempt the joke that would be bound to occur at some point during the show. The first person that says, "I'm skeptical of donating," ha ha, you, my friend, get the stink eye. It's not quite as effective on the radio, but just know it's there. So on to Brian Mallow. Brian has proclaimed himself Earth's premier science comedian. Based in San Francisco, Brian has performed for the National Institute of Standards and Technology at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, the National Association of Science Writers, and for Apple, Dell, and Microsoft. He's appeared on The Late Late Show with Craig Ferguson, which is and on the Tech TV, Discovery, and A&E. Brian currently writes and appears in science video essays for Time Magazine's website, and he has something very interesting. His Neil Armstrong routine was once heard aboard an orbiting space shuttle. He currently serves on the advisory board of the San Diego Science Festival and as a contributing editor to the Journal of Irreproducible Results. That is not fair to radio hosts, that word right there. His bio also notes that he is available for off-world appearances if transportation is provided. So welcome to Skeptically Speaking, Brian.
Hey, it's great to be here.
So let's just start this off. Now, you are the self-proclaimed Earth's premier science comedian.
Yes, I'm admitting right up front that nobody else gave me that title. I'm just claiming it because, you know, I don't know very many contenders.
This is a good point.
Yeah.
So what led you to become Brian Mallow, science comedian?
Well, you know what? I've been doing stand-up for a long time, longer than I care to admit sometimes, but going on 2 decades. And I was always science-flavored, more so than most comedians.
Science-flavored.
Yes.
That is a fantastic phrase.
Thanks. I made that up. I grew up a bit of a science geek. It was an interest of mine before comedy. And when I started doing stand-up, you could tell. I mean, it just informed my act from the beginning. I had a tendency to make geeky references and use sometimes geeky subjects. So what really is funny is that it took me so long to realize that that's what I should call myself and really focus on that.
So do you actually have a formal science background?
No, I was pre-med, so, and you know, for Jewish parents, that's a little bit of a career prick tease. I was pre-med, I had the high grades, I could have done it, but I just realized at the time that I wanted to do something else. I wanted to do something, creative and writing. At the time, I thought I wanted to be a rock star. I wrote songs when I was younger with a friend of mine who played keyboards. And I don't tend to tell people that because if you say that to people, I wanted to be a rock star, they usually ask you, well, what instrument do you play? And then I have to explain, I didn't say I wanted to be a musician. I said I wanted to be a rock star. So what was the question?
I think you've answered it. So what are, I guess, what are the normal demographics of a typical audience of yours?
Well, I still do perform at some comedy clubs, mm-hmm. but I've been focusing on performing for science organizations, science festivals, tech companies. What happened is I started realizing that my act, even in the nightclubs, was kind of science geeky, and most of it would work for any audience. But there were always some jokes that I wish more people would laugh at. And every once in a while, like, I did a private event for Apple or Dell or Microsoft, and there were a lot of engineers in the room, and I would pull those jokes out, and they would work really well. And that's when I started realizing I need to focus. I need to get that audience to always be in at my shows.
Right.
So now, if I do a show at a comedy club, we promote it as an evening of science humor. And the people that come out come for science humor. And there will be scientists, there will be science teachers, and then there will just be people like me, enthusiasts, maybe like yourself.
Absolutely like myself.
that are just that have always loved reading science for fun and self-educate. You know, I didn't have a formal science education, but Isaac Asimov and Arthur C. Clarke taught me a lot when I was young.
Right.
Yeah.
So is a background in science sort of integral to attending your show? I guess what I'm asking is, will people feel stupid if they don't have, like, a degree in physics?
No, not at all. Almost everything I do is geared towards a general audience. But I have some stuff that, if there are a lot of physicists in the room, I can make a more obscure reference and not explain it. But I can perform to any audience, and I think that they'd like it just like they'd like any comedian. It would just skew a little towards this little science geekiness.
The nerd, yeah. I approve of the nerd.
Right, like if I say that I used to be an astronomer, but I got stuck on the day shift.
Oh, that's not. Oh.
Yeah. I mean, you don't have to have any education. Not much of an education. And actually, if I have a really good audience, I actually do have to qualify that and say that I know that joke could be offensive to solar and radio astronomers, because they do work on the day shift.
That's an interesting point. But I do want to point out, I'm glad you're not going to make our listeners feel stupid.
No, not at all.
Especially today, because it's fundraising day. So we want to make them feel especially intelligent.
I think your listeners are brilliant and intelligent. And I have some stuff up on YouTube at youtube.com/sciencecomedian. Or if you Google science comedian, or if you search for that phrase on YouTube, you find me pretty easily.
Wonderful. And yes, there is a plethora of things about you out there, actually. You are very easy to research.
With more to come.
So if you have a question for Brian, audience, do give us a call at 780-492-2577, extension 7. Now that's new. It's extension 7 to talk to Brian, and extension 1 to talk to the people who will happily take your money. You can also...
Let's not confuse those two.
No. Well, no, either's good, really. You can also email in a question to live@skepticallyspeaking.com or tweet us at Skeptical Radio.
What's the extension if they want to give money directly to me?
1. Totally 1.
And they'll get a dial.
So do you consider what you do science outreach?
I guess I do. You know what? I consider what I do entertainment, and maybe, you know, striving to be smart entertainment. But more and more, and historically, but more and more, yeah, science outreach has become more and more important to me. And certainly with some of the things I'm doing, like at a science festival or maybe even at any comedy show, if I'm getting people to laugh at a topic that they wouldn't normally think is funny, then maybe I'm doing something there. I don't know. But what I'm doing at Time.com, Time Magazine's website, is making videos that they're not particularly funny. I think you saw some of them.
Mm-hmm.
They're in fact, they some of them say science comedian Brian Mallow, and they've gotten embedded in some blogs. And the first comment is, well, that's not very funny. And the truth is, I wasn't trying to be as funny as my stand-up with those mm-hmm. pieces. And those really are science outreach, science communication pieces. One was about Galileo and the year of astronomy. One was about, well, Lincoln's birthday and Darwin's birthday. February 12th of this year, their 200th birthday, and the 150th anniversary of The Origin of Species.
Well, I thought those were great videos, and you're right, they weren't, you know, if you fall off your chair, hilarious. They were just very accessible and very insightful. And actually, I wanted to ask a question about the video about Galileo and astronomy.
Yeah.
Because you mentioned the telescopes were probably initially used for porn.
Well, that's my own theory.
No, you think?
I just think that, like most new technologies, why not the telescope? Until astronomy became the killer app for the telescope,
right. Yeah,
it was probably just like any other new technology, probably used as porn, because before Galileo started making astronomical observations of significance, the telescope had been invented at least the year before. And, you know, they were looking at, I guess that you could use it to look at a ship in the distance, or maybe you could look at the neighbor girl across the way.
See, I, you know what? I always secretly thought that. And it's like you confirmed it for me.
I suspect just the fact that we both think that 400 years ago, I'll bet some people thought that as well.
It's a pretty small sample size, though, sir.
And of course, even though astronomy may have become the killer app, that doesn't mean that it's not still used for porn.
This is a good point. So there's also kind of a push in the entertainment world lately to make science not only understandable, but funny.
Right. Yeah.
Shows like Mythbusters and The Big Bang Theory. So yeah. do you consider yourself a part of that?
Absolutely, and I'm a fan of both of those shows. I think they're very different from each other. And obviously, you know, MythBusters is really attacking science ideas and myths and trying to dispel them or show evidence that they are true. And then Big Bang Theory is just a sitcom, but yeah, it's funny. So yeah, I think that, you know what? I think what I do, I'm also a big science fiction fan. Mm-hmm. And I think that what I do is very much like science fiction. It's making entertainment out of science material.
And I like that.
That was always my first goal. I never set out to educate people or do science outreach. I just was trying to be an entertainer, and I was doing it the only way I knew, with the materials that I'm familiar with. And science and science fiction, I drew from that very naturally. As I realized that I should focus on science comedy, and it was a good niche for me, and that it was what I was doing naturally already, that I started to realize and get feedback from people that that you could see it as science outreach, that, like I said, like getting people to laugh at some of these topics, or maybe even making points in the form of a joke.
Well, actually, on a related topic, this was sent in via the website before the show. Do you think the concept of making science fun has been inspiring young people to pursue careers in science?
Probably. I mean, I would hope so. You know, the thing is, for most of us, and probably most of your listeners, you feel like it's not necessary, because science itself is fun and exciting. Most of us feel that. Like, you know, how can you not get excited about concepts like black holes and neutron stars and relativistic space travel and even like the stuff we're learning about genetics and just science, just all the strength. You know what? I actually have a hobby of insect photography.
I read that.
Yeah. And I mean, the more you look at bugs, that when you get zoom in and look, get down on their level and see them, that's so fascinating. It's so astounding. And it just makes you think, what the hell is going on this planet? And it makes you want to learn more. In fact, a few weeks ago, I actually found in downtown San Francisco, I found a praying mantis. And I brought it home because it was on the streets. I don't think, you know, it was like a little street mantis. And I don't think that it was a good place for it to survive or thrive. I brought it home, and we ended up keeping it for about 3 weeks until I left on this road trip. And I could no longer, but we've actually bought crickets at a local aquarium, and for 3 weeks we kept this bug, and we didn't actually even keep it contained. We ended up, most of the time, it just sat in a house plant, and it was a really neat thing to have in the house. But praying mantids are very bizarre, and they turn their heads. They're very so alien.
They are absolutely creepy, actually.
Yeah. But in a good way.
That's
and it's kind
of love
funny.
That that's actually a concept.
Like,
there's creepy dolphin. In a good way.
Dolphins save tuna, and you always go, yeah, but everyone cares about the dolphin. Nobody seems to care about the tuna. And in that same way, we were buying crickets for the mantid. And, you know, the cricket's an interesting little creature, too. And I don't think he's a cousin to the praying mantis. But in our realm, the mantis was being fed the cricket.
So we have an email that was just sent in. Go ahead, Ryan.
Question is, which of your appearances was the most fun to do?
Wow. Which of my appearances was the most fun to do? That's really hard. There's different ones that have been fun for different reasons. One that was really exciting, last year I performed at the National Institute of Standards and Technology. And they have a really prestigious speaker series, and a lot of Nobel Prize winners and Pulitzer Prize winners and a science comedian, Stephen Jay Gould, and me. And they had me in December at the end of the year, like sort of their holiday season speaker, and that was really fun. And because there were a lot of physicists and chemists in the room, a variety of scientists, I've done a series of shows at a small museum in Washington, D.C. that's affiliated with the National Academy of Sciences. It's called the Marion Koshland Science Museum. And those shows were really fun. But frankly, in San Francisco, in the Bay Area, I've done some of my own shows at comedy clubs. And they've been fantastic because we promoted it as rational comedy for an irrational planet, an evening of science humor, and a great crowd came out. And in fact, you know, most of what I do is pretty clean, but if I'm performing in a nightclub as opposed to a museum setting, I feel like I can cut loose a little more. So it's a slightly different show, at least in part.
Right.
Yeah.
So everybody out there, if you want to get involved in this discussion, call us at 780-492-2577, extension 7. That's extension 7 to talk to Brian and I, and extension 1 to talk to the people at CJSR who will help you donate your hard-earned money. And again, you can also email in a question to live@skepticallyspeaking.com. And if you donate during the show or saunter down to the station, if you happen to live in the city, you have the chance to win one of three draw prizes. So I have here a potato clock. You can make a clock out of two potatoes. 'Cause science rules. I also have a book called Sneaky Uses for Everyday Things, and actually, my favorite prize of all, you could have this show immortalized in art form. Jill Powell, noted artist and member of the Skeptic.com blog collective, has drawn a fantastic picture of me interviewing Brian Mallow.
What?
Yes, yes, sir. And you know what? As our present to you for being on the show, I'm going to send you a copy as well.
Excellent.
You're juggling.
I'm juggling.
You're juggling.
Okay. What does that mean?
I think it's because it's funny.
Okay.
Okay. We don't question the creative, sir.
No. I can't wait to see it.
So actually, if everyone would like to see it, you can go onto Twitter right now. And intern Ryan has posted these wonderful prizes. And our Twitter stream, if you don't know, is @skepticalradio. Is there any area of science that you'd avoid in your routines for fear of offending people?
No, not necessarily. You know, well, first of all, in the realm of science, there really shouldn't be anything offensive to anyone. Because it's science. It's about reality. It's about the way the world works. So I don't think there should be anything that's really offensive. As we know, as comedians and as people who have all had dinner conversations, that religion could be a touchy subject, if that's what you might be asking about. That's probably a topic you've talked about on this show, haven't you?
Absolutely.
I just read an amazing book, Letter to a Christian Nation,
right,
by Sam Harris.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, have you read that one?
Mm-hmm.
It's really good.
It's
and
very
thought-provoking.
Good. So, well, has anything been sort of, I guess, too controversial for an audience in the past?
I'll tell you something funny. From years ago, an agent contacted me about performing at a birthday party. And they had seen a tape of me, and they really liked it. It was a short tape, and I guess I'd have to tell you this joke to let you know why. They wanted me... they wanted to hire me for their event, but they didn't want me to tell this one joke.
Okay.
And it's just about how, you know, my mom used to always tell me to stand up straight. Did you ever get that from your mom? Stand up straight?
No, I'm one of those. The ones who don't slouch.
Oh, yes. Well, it's pretty universal. Mothers, it seems to be built in, mothers telling their kids to stand up straight. I think mothers have been telling their kids that for longer than we realize. Perhaps even to pre-human days.
Oh, I see
yeah.
where you're going
what
with this.
What if that were the driving force behind the evolutionary trend to walk erect? Mothers nagging their children up the evolutionary ladder. Stand up straight. Don't drag your knuckles when you walk. You know, like that. So it's a very silly joke, right? I mean, clearly that's a silly joke. I'm not suggesting that that's, you know, really the mechanism behind evolution.
But that is definitely controversial.
Well, really? Because these people said, hey, we like him, we want him to perform at our party, but we don't want him to do that joke because we're Christians. And I just thought that that was somewhat insane because it was, they didn't want me to mention the word, like the joke is so absurd, but it had the word evolution. So, I mean, it's
fascinating.
It's actually a little scary. Yeah, it's actually a little scary to think that, wow, that they don't want to even hear that word, that somehow that joke, which is just so silly, they should be able to laugh at it. No matter what your belief is, you should be able to laugh at that because it's an absurd joke. And in fact, I told a different joke that night that was also on the tape they saw. And I just thought that if they're offended by that, they should have been offended by this other one, which is about asking my mom, why is the sky blue? And she said, because I said so. And to me, if you're offended by the one, then they should equally have been offended by that one, but that one didn't bother them. But, you know, am I really suggesting that's why the sky is
right.
blue? Isn't that just as offensive?
We actually have an email question.
Yes.
This is actually sent via Twitter by Kennedy G. He asks, who are the funniest scientists, and Neil deGrasse Tyson is his personal pick?
Dips. Oh, I love Neil Tyson. And in fact, several months ago, I got an email from him because he had seen some of my YouTube clips and he thought they were hilarious. And so I corresponded a little bit with him. But he's a great science communicator. He's funny and smart. I love him. You know what? Richard Feynman.
Mm-hmm.
Richard Feynman, if you've never... He's Nobel laureate. He made... interesting contributions to physics. He also helped figure out why the Space Shuttle Challenger blew up on the launch pad, or, you know, 90 seconds into its flight. And he was this brilliant, unbelievably brilliant man. And if you can find him on YouTube, and he's a hoot. He is so entertaining, and he's got this, I think, this thick New Jersey accent, which it just seems so funny to put with his, I don't know, somehow it just seems like he's almost, he could probably be on The Sopranos, but he's this brilliant physicist, and he's funny. Stephen Hawking is actually funny, and if you've ever read some of his stuff, he has a... He makes efforts to be funny in a few places.
I want to get back to science comedy because I have some specific questions about when should scientists not be funny. But I just noticed that it's still CJSR's fun drive, actually.
Ah.
So how can you help, you ask?
That's what I was about to ask.
You were. I know you were. You're a good man. you can dial and donate right this very second at 780-492-2577, extension 1. Also meander over to your computer and pledge online at skepticallyspeaking.com. And for all of you people who are worried about your finances, totally understandable. You don't have to pay in one lump sum. You can spread it out over a year. And if you've already donated... Thank you so, so much. We appreciate it for so many reasons. Because financially supporting CJSR is awesome and unbelievably necessary, of course, but also you're supporting science and skepticism. Because when you donate, you're showing that there's an audience for this kind of programming. When you donate, you're offering a tangible representation of your love for critical thought. And that's lovely. So thank you. And also, if you want to talk to Brian, he's also here. I don't know. It's not just FunDrive. It's totally Brian.
Yeah, you should check over on your Twitter page. I clicked over to the TwitPic, and I see somehow your artist must have a webcam on me because that's such a good likeness. And
I noticed that.
And it actually captures what I was doing a few minutes ago, juggling an amoeba, a microscope, Pi, and Saturn. I love when jugglers can juggle objects of that different mass. You know, amoeba on the one hand and Saturn.
She's good.
Books on my head.
So let's go back to when scientists should maybe not be as funny. You said Stephen Hawking is happy to be funny, which is good. Good. But is there any time that maybe some of their lame jokes make you wish they'd stick to the science?
No, I don't know. I do think that sometimes people are a little skeptical. They're wondering when they hear science comedian, I think sometimes they have this association that they've seen people that are scientists trying to be funny and they thought it wasn't funny. But I'm actually coming at it as a comedian first who just happens to love science. I don't know. I think, yeah, you hear a lot of corny jokes. And,
oh, a lot.
Yeah.
So we appreciate you starting out from the other side.
Yeah. But I don't know. I mean, I appreciate the effort sometimes.
Yeah, and there is that.
You know what I get asked a lot is, when I say that I perform to scientists, and they go, well, do scientists have a sense of humor? And what I found is that, yes, they do, but sometimes they're very literal-minded, and that's something that, and in a way, you know, maybe I deserve this because it's the way I've always been. And, for instance, I was doing a show, and I was talking about the heat in Arizona and about how it was 110 in Tucson, 125 at Lake Havasu. And I said, that just sounds like the surface of Venus. And from the back of the room, someone went, no.
Oh.
Venus is much hotter than that. And you know what? Honestly, I was aware of that. But I was using a comedic device called exaggeration.
Oh, it's not as funny when you have to explain.
Yeah, but I mean, so in that way, sometimes they're like, I have to be funny, of course, but unlike a lot of comedians, I'm being forced to be literally accurate, scientifically accurate. Sometimes, here's a great response. What comedians want from an audience is laughter first. We like applause, but laughter, then applause.
Right.
What I've had to decide is a great response and just accept it, is sometimes I tell a joke and I'll see someone in the front and they're thinking, and then they're nodding their head. It's like they're going, they have found that the joke is sound. And they're not, they're like, yes, okay, I find no flaw in that joke.
Oh.
You may carry on, comedian.
That's beautiful.
And
that
I have
beautiful.
To take that as a compliment. Go, okay, you know, he didn't actually laugh, but he found no flaw in the joke.
we received a tweet.
Ah.
Yes, this is from, I'm going to pronounce it, M. Gerskup. He asks, what's your favorite / best science-related joke?
Well, that's a tough one, but one of my favorites is I had a very frightening experience the other day. I was sitting at a cafe, and I noticed in the display case behind me someone had put pasta and antipasta right next to each other. Are they out of their Vulcan minds? And actually, that's an example of... Are you okay?
I'm fine. Go ahead. Do continue.
That's a joke that when I wrote it, I thought everyone would. I actually started doing that in nightclubs. And what I found is most people just stared. And then one or two people would be doubled over thinking it's the funniest joke. And the rest of the room was waiting for the punchline.
Oh.
And I was like, wow. And so there, it's like, you don't have to know much. It's just a matter antimatter joke.
Right.
Yeah. So I don't know if that's my favorite, but I do like that one.
We have about 15 minutes in the episode list.
Get funny. What?
What? No, you're lovely. You're lovely. What I want is more money. So since we have 15 minutes left, that is just enough time to donate by phone at 780-492-2577 extension 1 or online at skepticallyspeaking.com. And remember, that automatically enters your name into the draw for the aforementioned potato clock. The Sneaky Uses for Everyday Things book, or the lovely Jill Powell drawing of Brian and I. Really, it's beautiful. You should check
it
on Twitter.
I like it.
Also, if you want to actually come on the phone, what is with you people today?
Are they scared?
I think they are. I don't know why. All our tech is working today, which is miraculous.
This is actually my first time on Skype, if you can believe that,
really?
For a science comedian.
That's interesting. Well, I'm glad we brought you over to the dark side.
Yes, I've been meaning to get over here.
Just meandering your way?
Uh-huh.
Nice. No hurry, eh?
So here's something I want to tell you. You mentioned that I'm on the advisory board of the San Diego Science Festival.
Mm-hmm.
This happened earlier this year, and it was such a smashing success that the founder, Larry Bonk, is actually, I'm not sure there's going to be a San Diego Science Festival next year, but instead, there's going to be a USA Science Festival in Washington, D.C., and again, I'm on the advisory board, and it's going to be huge. It's poised to be the Woodstock of science. It's going to be in the fall of 2010 in Washington, D.C.
That's the hottest thing I've ever heard.
Yeah.
I know.
And it should be huge, and any science organizations or institutes that would like to be involved should look into it. they can contact me. I'm on Twitter at Science Comedian. Sciencecomedian.com is my website, and I'd be happy to hook up anyone that's interested in participating. But it's, you know what, the San Diego one was huge, and this is just going to be much, much bigger, I suspect.
I just wanted
the USA Science Festival, fall of 2010.
I just need to point out that the gentleman who just asked you that question on Twitter apparently laughed. So
good
success.
I have another one about I just hope I age gracefully. Like, you know what, I have some gray hair. I don't care. I've had it for a long time. I don't care if it goes all gray. I don't care if it goes blue. You know, I don't care if it goes ultraviolet. In fact, if I lose my hair, that's what I'm going to say. I'm not bald. I have hair. It's just outside your visible spectrum. Don't try to tell.
Totally consider that stolen. Hopefully not for me, because that's cool. Okay, I have a bunch of bonus questions here.
We're in the bonus round.
We're in the bonus round. So what is the funniest element to say?
You know what? I actually have an answer to that.
Oh, my God.
Because
of course you do.
I do, because one time my sister was visiting San Francisco, and I was going to take her out for Chinese food, and we had this conversation, and I basically riffed this joke, and then I mentioned a couple elements, and later I went to the table of the elements, the periodic table of the elements, just to see, it's like, oh, if I'm going to use that as a joke, I should make sure I have the funniest sounding ones. And sure enough, the one that I ended with is clearly the funniest sounding one. See if you don't agree. I was going to take my sister out for Chinese food. She said she doesn't eat Chinese food because it has too much sodium in it. But isn't that ridiculous to single out one element from the periodic table? You'd have to have a pretty sensitive palate, right? Like, you know, I don't eat Mexican food, too much magnesium. Or, waiter, I asked for the beryllium on the side. Nothing ruins a ham and cheese sandwich like a tad too much molybdenum.
That.
And molybdenum.
Thank you.
It's clear. You can refer to the periodic table. I defy you to tell me a funnier sounding element than molybdenum.
I don't even know what that is. Molybdenum?
Yeah, it's one of our elements. I wish I could tell you the atomic number, but that's what Google is for.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Next bonus
question. So molybdenum is the answer to that.
Thank you. and again,
and
audience,
I think beryllium sounds kind of funny.
Beryllium sounds kind of dirty. I always thought
sounds
so.
Dirty.
I don't know why.
All right. Well, sometimes, you know, sometimes this is more a reflection of the person than the element.
This is true. This is what I've been told. Again, audience, 780-492-2577. If you want to talk to Brian, that's extension 7. If you want to talk to the money people, please do that as well. That's extension 1. Okay, so the funniest name of a scientist that you've
funniest
come across.
Funniest name of a scientist. Wow. No, that's a tough one. I don't know. Funniest name of a singer, Engelbert Humperdinck. That's
easy. Yeah, that one works.
I don't know. Pass. We'll come back to that one.
Okay.
If you want to ask me about creationism, I would say that I'm kind of a hardliner. I don't even think creationism should be taught in church. I'll substitute that answer to that question.
I get substitute jokes. That's awesome.
Yeah. In fact, you know, the fact that so many people to this day don't believe in evolution might be the strongest evidence that we really aren't evolving.
Oh.
Or at least it's proof of what a slow process it is.
Again, people, if you're listening online, as I'm sure most of you are, you can also go to skepticallyspeaking.com and right below Brian's picture. It's fantastic. You look very dapper, sir, in that picture.
Dapper. That's what I'm going for.
Good.
The dapper science comedian.
You've succeeded. Right below
capable
his picture.
Capable of juggling Saturn and an amoeba.
Right below his picture is a link to the online platform.
Intangible things like pie. Intangible concepts.
You can juggle a concept. That is something.
Yeah.
That's something.
And a planet. And there's only 8 now. We're running out of planets.
We are. I know.
Pretty soon they're going to raise the bar so that even Earth isn't a planet.
I wonder what we'd be considered.
A planetoid.
A planetoid. Good, good. So, if you could pick a mad scientist from a movie or a television show to be your arch nemesis, who would you choose?
Arch nemesis?
You have to add arch. It's not just nemesis.
A mad scientist to be my arch nemesis.
Mm-hmm.
That's a tough one. You've got me stumped. Let's see.
I'm actually going to make it harder. You can't pick Dr. Evil because it's lame.
Yeah, I wouldn't say Dr. Evil.
No, I didn't think you would.
Maybe, you know, from the old classic H.G. Wells, The Island of Dr. Moreau. Dr. Moreau, just because you would be going up against these weird genetic these creatures that he created, that would be a weird arch nemesis to have out on this island making weird half-human, half-animal hybrids.
I like that. And you know what? I've never heard that answer.
Yeah.
Well done.
Thanks. Okay.
Next, what fictional...
How many people have you even asked that question of? Okay.
You know, you're lucky you didn't get my usual one, which is... Okay. Well, you know, I'm going to ask it now, because you're right here.
Go ahead.
So when you're walking down the street, do you have a certain song that plays in your head? Like your own personal soundtrack?
Do I have my own personal soundtrack? You know, not one song like the Brian theme, like that Darth Vader has his theme. Yes, it's the theme. It's Darth Vader's dun, 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 dun.
Shut up. That was PZ Myers. He totally picked that. Just so you know, that was
really?
His theme song. Yeah.
No, more often, it would probably be Birdhouse in Your Soul by They Might Be Giants.
Oh, also a good choice.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty compelling pop song.
So, now, what fictional technology would you most like to have access to?
Oh, you know, I think I right off the bat, fictional technology, time travel is, I mean, that's kind of classic. I don't know, but I don't know what can beat that. That's so fascinating of what you could do with that and explore history and see dinosaurs. And I've actually given a lot of, I've thought a bit about time travel. I think it's a pretty fascinating topic. And I actually asked a friend of mine if he thought it was possible at all, and he said absolutely not, because if we ever invented time travel, then we would already have visitors here amongst us. But I say, you know, maybe we do. They're not going to be obvious, are they? They're not going to, you know, they're not going to wear leotards and silver spandex. They're going to, you know, wear the clothes of our time. If they have pointy ears, they're going to wear ski caps. And I don't even know when there's another Jew around, let alone a time traveler. So I mean, maybe they're here. And on the chance that there are, every once in a while when I meet a stranger, instead of asking them, where are you from, I like to ask, when are you from? In the hope that I might trip one up.
Oh.
So I'll go, when are you from? And he'll go, 2170, when are you from? I'll go, now, get a net. I told you they were real. You didn't believe me. Maybe use something more advanced than a net. I don't know. A net is actually very dependable technology. Plus, he's from the future. He should have seen it coming.
You know, I've actually always thought that maybe visitors came... And they just thought we were kind of lame.
You know, there's the idea, look at the vastness of history. There's no certainty that they'd be visiting us now, because maybe this isn't a very interesting time period. When you have millions of years of history to explore, it's a little self-centered of us to think that this would be a time. You know, if I ever invented a time machine, the first trip I would take is into the future to get the more advanced model.
Ooh.
Yeah.
I want the
You know what the people say about time travel? That, I mean, the one that's the killer that a lot of people say makes it impossible is that it creates paradoxes.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I'm sure you know the classic paradox, the grandfather paradox.
Mm-hmm.
If you went back in time and killed your grandfather before your father was even born,
right?
Then you would never have been born. So how could you have gone back in time and killed your grandfather? It's a paradox, but I think I solved it. Your grandmother had an affair. You
Score.
Killed the wrong guy. Your grandmother was a hussy. Paradox lost.
And you know, tarts save us again. I have to say, so many times.
Saved us from a universal paradox. So I don't know, what do you have another fictional technology that... If not that, faster than light travel would be nice. That would be great, because...
Better than time, though? I think time sort of covers faster than light travel.
Maybe it does, but what
because
if
technically
time
you
travel,
could just use that.
If we can only explore here... You know, there's another big flaw, a big problem with time travel that maybe you could rationalize, is that if you move in time, then you'll just end up in outer space, because the Earth has moved. The Earth is moving, the solar system is moving, the galaxy is spinning, the galaxy is orbiting other galaxies, clusters of galaxies are in orbit. So we think that you'll end up, if you went 10 minutes in the past, you would still be in your bedroom 10 minutes ago, but the fact is, you'd be 10 minutes behind Earth's orbit in space.
Dude.
Unless somehow it's tied to, like, a gravity well or something.
You just totally blew my mind.
I know. But I'm not the first person to say that. It's that idea, I started, it's funny how, you know that thing about memes that sometimes you've never heard something and then you start seeing it everywhere?
Mm-hmm.
It was in a book by called Timescape by Gregory Benford, a great science fiction novel. And then, and it's like, I don't know, 10, 15 years old, maybe actually older. And then I saw Asimov make a mention of it quite a long time ago as well. And so suddenly I've stumbled upon a couple references to that, but that could be a problem. But let's say time travel worked just the classic H.G. Wells way.
Oh, we've actually lost our guest. Well, color me surprised. You know, this is a great opportunity now to actually draw for the draw prizes. So, who do I have here? I have Ken O.M. He has won the first prize, which is the aforementioned potato clock. Kate R. has won the book, The Sneaky Uses for Everyday Things. And David L. has actually won the Jill Powell original, which is lovely. Can you actually hear me, sir?
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to save the you should send us money because of all the technical difficulties bit for next episode, because that's also fundraising. But actually, that's actually all the time we have today.
Figured. See, so, that's where time travel would come in.
I would be using it all the time. You have no idea. And thanks so much to everybody else who donated while we were on air. And thanks to all of you who are going to donate after you download this on iTunes. We appreciate it very much. And listeners, if you do plan to donate when we're not live on air, please remember to note that you're donating because of Skeptically Speaking. Because we need to show evidence that Skeptical Radio is listener supported. Evidence, my friends. Mm-hmm. And if you're more of a phone person, don't worry if you didn't get the chance to donate today, because we're still fundraising on next week's show. And on next week's show,
The very, very funny
Randall Monroe, creator of the Wicked Good webcomic, XKCD. So if you don't know the comic, you, my friend, have not been on the internets enough.
You're not a science geek if
Seriously.
You don't know XKCD.
He is a meme unto himself, would you not say?
Oh, yes. And definitely worth checking out. Maybe definitely one of my favorite cartoons.
Awesome. Brian, thank you so much for being here.
Yeah,
we really, really appreciate it. You're lovely.
Thanks.
So check Skeptically Speaking for more details about next week. Thanks to everyone for your support of the show. And we have a different theme song that we're going to be playing tonight in honor of the fundraising. And we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Here's a try. Scratch. You must first invent the universe. Space is filled with a network of wormholes. You might emerge somewhere else in space. Some went out in time. The sky calls to us. We do not destroy ourselves. We will one day venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rose. A morning filled with 400 million suns. The horizon of the Milky Way. The cosmos is full beyond measure. Elegant truths of exquisite interrelationships of the awesome machinery of nature. I believe our future depends powerfully on how well we understand this cosmos, in which we float like a mote of dust. The morning sky. But the brain does much more than just recollect. It intercompares, it synthesizes, analyzes, it generates abstractions. The simplest thought, like the concept of the number one, has an elaborate logical underpinning. The brain has its own language for testing the structure and consistency of the world. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rose. A morning 400 billion suns, the horizon of the Milky Way. The sky calls to us. If we do not destroy ourselves, we will one day
adventure to the stars.
For thousands of years, people have wondered about the universe. Did it stretch out forever, or was there a limit? From the Big Bang to black holes, from dark matter to a possible big crunch, a remnant of the universe today is full of strange-sounding ideas.
How lucky we are to live in this time, the first moment in human history when we are, in fact, visiting other worlds. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rose.